Tonight on Arena, it's review night with John Boyne's latest novel, The Echo Chamber, and new albums from Will Young, Willie Mason and Paddy Casey, all under the microscope. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. In John Boyne's new novel, The Echo Chamber, BBC TV presenter George Cleverly has it all. A successful career, five-storey house in London's Belgravia, a wife who's an established novelist, and three children. His lovely life, however, is about to skid off the rails. His oldest son, Nelson, has just signed on with a new therapist, who also happens to be George's girlfriend on the quiet. And then the liberal chat show host sends out a well-meant but ill-worded tweet. Mary McGill has been reading The Echo Chamber by John Boyne. She joins me this evening. John Boyne clearly having a lot of fun here and has quite definitely has social media in his target, in his eyepiece here. He gave George's wife, Beverly, for example. She's called Beverly, so she's Beverly Cleverly. How cleverly has he constructed this entire satire, John Boyne, would you say, Mary?
I'll tell you, Sean, it's incredibly entertaining. Right from the opening pages, we are left in, I think, no doubt as to what John's feelings on social media are. So we get a quote from Umberto Eco describing it as the invasion of the idiots. And we get a rather sobering quote then from John Ronson from his brilliant book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. And it says, the snowflake never needs to feel responsible for the avalanche. So that sets the scene for this introduction to the Cleverlys, as you described there. They're clever, cleverly by name, but not so cleverly by nature. At least, you know, they're very secure in their lot when we meet them first. And why wouldn't they be? Because their lot is exceptionally privileged. And they all like to think of themselves as very progressive and well-intentioned and, you know, upstanding people. But as we quickly discover, their fortunes rest on very, very shifting sands, which social media plays a key role.
Yeah, now hardly surprising that John Boyne might want to write something about social media, given particularly the reaction around his 2019 novel, My Brother's Name is Jessica. A story that he had said that he thought was a sensitive take on transitioning, but that was not the reaction that necessarily it got. Now, in the case of the novel, The Echo Chamber, he makes George, who's the BBC TV presenter, the patriarch of the family, of the Cleverly family, he has him make a faux pas on Twitter around the whole transitioning topic. That's a risky enough move in some ways.
It certainly is. And George clearly isn't aware of it at all. And this is where the kind of privilege, you know, he's someone who comes from a very comfortable background. Boyne tells us repeatedly, you know, he's many millions in the bank and he's used to moving through the world in a very confident way, Sean. So he fires off this tweet that he assumes is not only fine, but actually very nice, very supportive. And he quickly learns that he is way, 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 way off the mark. And what we see here, and I think it's a very interesting dynamic, and I think it's one people are very familiar with if they're active on social media, is that George has you know, kind of tripped over something that he wasn't aware existed. But what he does, rather than kind of holding his hands up and saying, you know, my cuppa you know, waiting for the tide to turn or a new controversy to come along, he goes on the BBC Evening News and makes the most spectacular non-apology. So he trips over and then kicks the hornet's nest. Yeah. And then what plays out, I think, is a kind of an ageism that works both ways. So you've George of a particular generation who's used to being the most enlightened and most progressive person in the room, who can't understand why he's getting this kind of reaction. Then you've a younger generation who are now kind of inheriting that mantle, and they're extremely frustrated and antagonized by him. And of course, both these cohorts are shouting at each other on social media, you know, and it's getting ever more intense. But this is, you know, while it's very stressful and upsetting for the people involved, the social media companies, and Boyne is very shrewd in the way he points this out as well, are you know, doing tremendously well out of all of this outrage and this upset. So we have complicated issues that are not being solved, but the social media companies are doing very, very well.
And is it, are we clear as to just how way off the mark George has been in his tweet? And are we clear as to just how much outrage on the part of those who react to his tweet, how justified that outrage is?
I think we are. I think George, in kind of revelling in the upset that he's caused, just does not do himself any favours. Mm. But at the same time, you know, Boyne is also very, very good at pointing out the way social media becomes its own feedback loop. I mean, that's what the title is about, right? The echo chamber. The way, so this feedback, this loop starts and nothing is resolved. It's just, a whole lot of outrage and a whole lot of upset. And the moment that might have been there for learning or change or whatever else gets overtaken by this huge, spectacle. And of course, the media seizes on it as well, because it's content, it's news, it's a bit of gossip and all the rest of it. And it goes on and it rolls on and it rolls on. Yeah. So, you know, as I said, social media companies do really well out of it. The rest of society, I'm not so sure.
All right. Now, that obviously the whole social media debate is very much at the centre of this, but we can't ignore the nature of the children, and they're adult children, it has to be said here. Nelson, Elizabeth and Achilles. You could forgive them for being a little bit annoyed, particularly Nelson and Achilles, given Achilles is a difficult name to carry around, I would have thought. Nelson is named so because he's named after Nelson Mandela. I'm not sure about Elizabeth, whether Elizabeth has a particular reason for being called Elizabeth, but they're quite a bunch of kids.
They're quite, yes, they certainly are. If there was ever a cautionary tale about raising your children and overindulging in the cleverly children are certainly that. So we have, yes, the Nelson, named after Nelson Mandela, who's the eldest. He's rather odd. He's socially awkward. To give you an example, you know, when he feels he has to go and socialise or be in public, he often dresses in uniforms like nurses' scrubs or as a policeman. And as you can imagine, that generally is not a good idea and ends up getting him into various scrapes. Then we have Achilles, who actually, Sean, you know what, is actually very good at inhabiting his name. He is very vain. He's very cruel and very greedy. And he's a scam merchant that is running a very dubious number, luring older men over dating apps and then kind of blackmailing them. So not a nice guy. But saying that, he's not as bad as his sister Elizabeth, who, for me anyway, is the worst of the Cleverly children and certainly the most fascinating.
I was interested in this. You were both appalled by her, but equally she appealed to you.
Yes, because she has a kind of psychology that I think a lot of us think about in this day and age. And what I mean by that is, you know, she's you know, very privileged. She doesn't work. She's vague notions about being a poet. But what she really wants to do is to build a profile for herself online. So she wants to be kind of internet famous and then, you know, convey that into fame more broadly. And she even sets up her own sex tape in this regard and releases it. But her real passion, the one thing that seems to really get her exercised in her life, is trolling people via this anonymous Twitter account that she has, including her own father. And when I say trolling, I mean, you know, serious abuse directed at celebrities, politicians and anyone else who disagrees with her. And she will do this while she's, you know, wandering around her very well-appointed house in Belgravia. And she just seems to have no awareness of the harm that she's causing, or no awareness of the humanity of the people that she is directing this malicious material to. It's all just a lark. And she's almost incapable, inevitably, when this stuff begins to catch up with her, of understanding what it is that she has done and the harm that she's caused. And it is just, it's a fascinating description of someone who is, you know, you're looking at them and it's like, you're just wondering how it is. And at the same time, it's completely believable that someone should be this disconnected from the maliciousness that they're putting out there. And of course, this is what social media enables, is this kind of dehumanising process.
But it is interesting that the troll here is perhaps not from the demographic that we would immediately associate with trolls in real life, if we can talk about social media and real life in the same breath.
But I think that's a, I think that's a valid point too, right? You know, the assumptions that we make. I mean, a lot of what Elizabeth does, Sean, is because she's bored. Like, she literally does not have anything else going on. She has an abundance of time and an abundance of energy and nothing really to put it into. So it's almost like a kind of a really childish bullying mentality that she gets a bit of a kick out of. But yes, and it just goes to show you, and I think this is an important point as well, and I think Boyne, you know, and you get a real sense of this as you're reading the book, is social media having us, or are we having it? Like, who is using who? Because it, you know, it just does not, and you kind of feel yourself questioning your own relationship to it as you're laughing and reading the book. Because, I mean, I think he does draw an underline, you know, is this a question of technology appealing to our better selves or our worse selves? And I think he's pretty clear about his perspective on that.
Obviously, you've written about this yourself, a work of nonfiction, in fact, about social media called The Visibility Trap. In terms of what John Boyne is doing here is he ramps up the farce, I think it's safe to say, in terms of the satire that he's going to put in front of us. But is he even-handed in how he treats, you know, is there any sympathy for people who perhaps use social media in a good way, or any, is there any sign of something like that in the book?
I think there's a real sign, and I will say this to kind of show you the compassion with the way he portrays the Cleverleys. I mean, I think anybody who's been listening to us thus far will think, God, these are awful people. But he does show that that there is a loving family in there. It's just been, you know, kind of corrupted, particularly since the arrival of social media and each of them spending far too much time online.
Yeah, because just let me explain that. I suppose at certain points along the book, he gives us a day of the week, and he gives us a picture of the family, the Cleverley family, in previous times when they were more loving perhaps and a little bit less nasty. But immediately afterwards he gives us a simultaneous invention, if you like, in the world of social media. The suggestion there being that social media was the destruction of the Cleverley family, and by I suppose we can extrapolate that social media therefore is destroying in general terms.
Yes, yeah, and I think that's quite subtly done. And I think what's striking about those kind of moments throughout the book is, you know, this is very recent history, right? You're talking about, you know, from about 2005, 2006 on. So it's not that long ago that this whole shift in how we engage with technology has happened. And of course, so this book is coming, you know, as we hopefully emerge from a year and a half when we have become more reliant on technology than ever before. And the pandemic is referenced in the book as kind of, you know, having happened and life seems to have gone back to normal, but there is a real sense that that this normal in the social media age is a place where mistakes become catastrophes. Life is something that you perform for people you don't even know. Bad situations are made worse by being filmed and put online, and, you know, lives are destroyed and problems go unresolved.
Certainly, it's a thought-provoking book. Did it work for you overall? Were you entertained? Were, you said that you found yourself questioning your own relationship with social media. What was the ultimately was the effect of reading John Boyne's The Echo Chamber for you, Mary?
Well, part of it was wanting to log off forever. I did laugh a lot. I did question my own sense of personal responsibility in engaging with these spaces. I also questioned their role in my sanity. And I have to say, you know, for all this pomp and bluster, George cleverly sometimes gets it right. Like when he says of the titans of Silicon Valley, all those clever little psychopaths, they're the Oppenheimers of the 21st century. I have to say, it's hard not to agree with them.
So you're recommending this. Do you have any caveats around the book?
I think the farce sometimes just doesn't land. It's too farcical for its own good. And one thing I would like to have seen more of is the kind of mob mentality is not restricted to one political perspective online. You know, whatever your political persuasion, these kind of impulses come from, you know, the whole spectrum of politics out there. So I would have like, it was, you know, the woke aspect of it was kind of the main focus. It would have been great to broaden that out and see how it works from all different directions on the political spectrum.
All right, that's Mary McGill speaking to us about John Boyne's novel, The Echo Chamber, which is published by Doubleday. Written, directed and created by Joseph Gordon-Levitt and starring the self-same award-winning filmmaker and actor in the lead role, Mr. Corman arrives on Apple TV Plus this weekend. The 10-part comedy series finds Gordon-Levitt taking on the role of a fifth-grade school teacher named Josh Corman from Los Angeles' San Fernando Valley. What's the problem with Joss? Well, in another life, this 30-something musician turned full-time educator might have been a rock star. Alas, that was not to be. And to make matters worse, Josh's family don't know what to do with him. He's struggling to get over a bad breakup. His anxiety has started to get the better of him. So is this really a comedy or is Mr. Corman something else entirely? Chris Wasser is going to elucidate and make me know which it is. let's start with Joseph Gordon-Levitt. He's been quite open, really, in terms of this piece, saying it's the kind of the sliding doors relationship that this character has to his own life. That's what he's looking at. That's might have been.
Yeah, and even in one interview, he said, look, my name is Joseph Gordon-Levitt and this character's name is Josh Corman. So there are some similarities there in basically the way that, you know, his interest in the music and the film that he watches, but also just in some of his character traits. But it's not him. It's basically just a what if. This is a show all about what if my life hadn't gone the way I'd wanted to. What if I didn't, you know, succeed in my dreams of being this artist? In Joseph Gordon-Levitt's case, an actor, although at one stage he did want to be a rock star. In Josh Corman's case, he was all set to front a band. They were going to be successful, but I think the big problem was that Josh, the main character, his relationship with the singer played by Juno Temple, her name is Megan, it falls apart, and then the dream falls apart. So Gordon-Levitt's kind of looking at it and thinking, right, okay, what would I have done then? I might have been a teacher, and then later on in the show we kind of see some other avenues he might have gone down. Where would I have ended up living? In Josh's case, when the band falls apart, he goes back to his school friend Victor, played by Arturo Castro, and they start renting this kind of crummy apartment in the San Fernando Valley. And he gets his teacher's degree and he seems pretty happy with the gig of being a fifth grade teacher because he likes the kids that he's teaching. Yeah. But everything else in his life, from his relationship with his family to his relationship with, you know, his former musical friends, it's in a bit of a state. But the biggest problem is Josh's confidence and his anxiety. He used to have problems with anxiety, but he's never experienced it the way he does here. And when we first meet him, everything is in a bit of a state. He's probably most happiest when he's in the classroom. When he gets home, doesn't know what to do with himself.
He doesn't get much help from Victor.
No.
In that respect. Because in the scene that we're about to listen to, they're trying to decide what to do with their evening. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Arturo Castro as Josh and Victor, respectively.
I need to do something tonight. Can we please do that?
Yeah, why don't you just play some music? No? Okay. How about some Mario Kart?
Dude, no.
Then what do you want to do then?
I'm asking you.
Oh. All right. This is hard.
I know.
It feels like it shouldn't be this hard.
I know.
Okay, we can figure this out. We could go out and find some girls.
Find some girls.
Yeah.
Like, find your keys.
Oh, come
like
on.
Find an animal to go hunt.
What's that
and
animal?
Kill
what's that killing animal?
Her?
No, you were the one that said there was a girl at a store. Something about
woman. Her. I didn't say a girl.
Oh,
I said a
my
woman.
God. Who do you think you're talking to? I respect women.
You know what? This isn't about girls. All right? We women. Could do women. We could do anything at all tonight.
All right.
Right? Mm-hmm. Do you remember back before we could drive, we used to talk all this about everything we were going to do once we could do anything we wanted to? So, like, if we were 15 again, what would we do?
Go to a bar and talk to girls.
It's true.
There you go. Josh and Victor, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Arturo Castro, in the scene there from Mr. Corman, which starts on Apple TV this weekend. Apple TV Plus, in fact, this weekend. And Chris Wasser has been looking at it for us. Yeah, at one level, you know, it's a kind of a classic setup there. Two guys in an apartment, you know, the life hasn't gone quite the way they want it to go, break up, all of the rest of it. That's kind of real world stuff. But, there's an asteroid.
There is an asteroid.
There's okay. some music. There's some animation.
There's an awful lot of music and there is some animation that sometimes Mr. Corman kind of resembles something of a pop-up storybook. So I think the important thing going into this is to know that not an awful lot happens in this show and not an awful lot happens at a very slow pace. So that's the basic setup that I've given you there and that's the basic relationship that he has with Victor. And there is no kind of magical plot device that moves, you know, that all of a sudden changes his life. It's basically 5 to 6 hours or in the case of the show, a year with Mr. Corman watching him try to figure out how to be in the world, how to exist. And while he tries to exist, we start to see some fabulous visual motifs take place. And these are the things that really stuck out for me. And this is why I love when Joseph Gordon-Levitt actually gets behind the camera when he's writing stories. For instance, when he begins to have his first panic attack, you see an asteroid in the corner of the screen. And we spend the rest of the day with Josh. He doesn't really know what's happening. He's never had an anxiety attack before. And every time he looks up at the sky, the asteroid seems to be getting closer. And I understand how some viewers might think that's a bit crude or over the top, but for me, I found that a spot on depiction of what is stomach churning anxiety. I thought that was very good. And you also start to get a bell clanging whenever Josh is not feeling great. And then when things get really, really bad, he slips into his mind. And his mind is like this, as I said, pop-up storybook. Some of it is, animated collages. Sometimes he kind of turns the situations and conversations with his friends into almost like a comic book or a video game sequence. Yeah. And in one lovely moment, instead of seeing a kind of a conversation or a non-conversation with his mom, played by Deborah Winger, we actually see the two of them perform a musical number like something out of Damien Chazelle's La La Land. Yeah. So that's what it has going for it. That's what I loved about it.
Yeah, I mean, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he's playing a young man in his 30s here. He can't be that far out of his 30s himself if he even is out of his 30s yet. But what a pedigree he has in his 3 to 4 decades of life.
Absolutely. He actually just turned 40 earlier this year. Yeah. He's a bit of a superstar creatively. I mean, he was a bit of a teen superstar, actually. Great child actor, starred in everything from A River Runs Through It with Robert Redford when he was, still in single digits. He was in Disney's Angels in the Outfield, but he kind of broke on through when he was 15 in Third Rock from the Sun as one of the four, aliens who arrive on Earth and they're posing as humans with John Lithgow and Fred Stewart. Fabulous sitcom, and that did really make him a star. It's the same in terms of film with 10 Things I Hate About You. He actually took some time off for a while because when he, was in his early 20s, thought, maybe I want to be an academic. I always wanted to study French, didn't get to finish school, wanted to go to college. But while he was in college, then realized, no, actually, acting is where it is. And ever since he's returned, in those 18 years, he has carved out a prolific and at times phenomenally successful career. If not as, this Oscar-nominated leading man, as the supporting character in an awful lot of great films for an awful lot of brilliant filmmakers who you always want to know more about. So he was the sidekick to Leonardo DiCaprio's Dream Thief in Inception. He played the Secret Robin in The Dark Knight Rises. He was a time travel assassin in Rian Johnson's Looper. Wonderful, wonderful science fiction and drama films. And also most famous of all, it was not a science fiction or drama film, but a romantic comedy, 500 Days of Summer.
Yeah.
And actually, Mr. Corman is probably in that ballpark where you do have this bit of a sad sack character who doesn't really know what way the world works. So, when things get bad, he kind of creates a fantasy version of it. But I think he has just started in the last few years with his production company Hit Record and also with writing, directing and starring in Don John. He started to make his own stories. Because I think maybe he has been looking for roles that just aren't there. And you have to commend that then that, he's actually creating them for himself.
And in Don John, which you say wrote, star, and directed in, that showed a kind of a promise that I think people thought, wow, this guy really has something even beyond the early successes that you've spoken about.
Yeah,
there.
The thing I loved about Don John is that this guy could have gone off and made his own action film. He could have made something that wouldn't, show him to be, show a vulnerable side. And in Don John, he wrote, directed, produced, and starred in and played this Italian-American kind of he's a bit of a womanizing character who has a crippling pornography addiction. And it's a very personal, intimate piece of filmmaking. It's almost as though you took like the Saturday Night Fever story and turned it into something a little bit more awkward. And he was able to bring in an A-list cast because of his reputation as an actor. Scarlett Johansson, Julianne Moore was there. But in that film, we saw something that was very funny, very moving, and very confident, which is what brings us then into Mr. Corman.
He brings in a few A-listers into Mr. Corman as well, not least of whom is Juno Temple. Here she's cast as his ex-girlfriend, and she's also in Apple's Ted Lasso
that
we spoke about in recent times as well. What about the cast around him? Has he chosen well as a director?
He has chosen well as a director, and in Arturo Castro playing Victor, he just brings this wonderful light touch to proceedings because Josh is so sad and he is so down on himself. One of the episodes is entirely devoted to Victor, and it's actually called Mr. Morales for half an hour, and that is just That was probably my favourite episode. We have Deborah Winger then, the great Deborah Winger, playing his mum Ruth. She again kind of goes for the more comedy side of things. We have Hugo Weaving playing his father, kind of giving it. There's an entire episode which is revolves around just a late night conversation between Josh and his father, which is just super. And then you know, there's just an awful lot of great supporting players that come in and out. The music is terrific. Juno Temple gets in there when Josh finally kind of reunites on friendly terms with his ex-girlfriend. Great cast.
Yeah, I'm starting to not like your Joseph Gordon-Levitt, okay, all of us. Yeah. I know, that's unfair. I mean, clear. He talks about this, and maybe this is a theme that comes up in this TV series itself. How lucky was Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
Yeah.
How lucky or unlucky, as the case may be, is Mr. Common? The theme of luck is important here.
It is, yeah, because he has asked in his career, how lucky was I that, you know, I managed to be a child actor that went on to have a successful career as a teenager? And then when I moved away from it, I was actually welcomed back. That is rare. I mean, it's rare to find a successful child actor who stars in Disney films that doesn't have a moment where their career, their personal life goes off the rails. And he has been wondering, in actually creating Don John and creating Mr. Corman, what if it had all gone sideways? And he brings that into the storytelling, where every now and then, either it's Victor, it's the kids in the class, it's his mum, it's his dad, they do kind of question, how much of a part does luck play in your life?
Let's listen to him in the class then, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, speaking to the kids that he's teaching about luck.
Do you think that a lot of success comes down to luck?
Definitely.
Interesting. Okay, who agrees with Paul about this? Anybody? Anybody disagree? Nice. Ramon, what do you think?
No. Like, if you're successful, that's because you work for it. You could be like, oh, I got bad luck. But when somebody says they got bad luck, they did something, you know? They lied, they stole something.
Okay.
I'm serious.
No, I know, and that's a good argument. But I'm curious how everyone feels about this. Who here thinks they're lucky? I want everyone to answer this question, all right? I'll give you a second to think about it. Now, raise your hand if you think you're a lucky person. Just Ramon. Okay, raise your hand if you think you're unlucky. Got it. Okay, you can put your hands down.
What about you, Mr. Corman?
What's that?
You didn't raise your hand.
Me? No, I mean, I feel like a lucky person.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt there in a scene from Mr. Corman. Clearly he knows how to work with children. Sure, he was a child star himself, so why wouldn't he know? What do you think of this series? It sounds very interesting, I have to say, overall, Chris.
It is. Interesting is definitely the word for it. I would say it's not a comedy, and it has been marketed in some ways as a comedy, and it's not a straightforward drama either, but it is something that you might have to stick with, because I mentioned at the top there, sometimes not an awful lot happens in it, but if you do stick with it, it sticks with you, and I think he has created something that is entirely unique. And also, I should add, Mr. Corman is not always a likable character, but that's kind of what makes him interesting.
And I suppose the other thing is, this is interesting, this is coming back in terms of the streaming platforms. You're only going to get two episodes on Friday and one every Friday after that. So we're getting back to old style television in a funny way.
I like that, because it does mean that he will be with us until October, and it does mean that you don't run the risk of binging on it and then just hating the character
and
by the end.
Water cooler moments can happen. Then
absolutely.
If we ever get back into the office when it comes to work. Anyway, that's a different argument. So you want us to watch this?
I do, yeah. I thought he was terrific in it, and I think he is as confident and as capable a storyteller as he is a performer, and that's great to see. And I'm actually looking forward to either another series of this or seeing what he does next, even if it's on the big screen.
Take it all back. I do like him. It's just a little bit of begrudgery in there. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, first two episodes of Mr. Corman. That's what Chris Wasser has been speaking to us about. Those first two episodes available on Apple TV Plus from tonight, isn't it? Yes, Friday, August the 6th. And so two album reviews on this Friday evening. First up will be Will Young, now 42-year-old singer, songwriter, actor and author, who rose to fame two decades ago as the winner of the inaugural Pop Idol, the ITV talent show. He's long since outgrown his TV pop star status, winning respect in critical circles, maintaining widespread commercial appeal at the same time. New album out today is called Crying on the Bathroom Floor. Next, Irish singer, songwriter Paddy Casey, Turn This Ship Around, is the title of his first album in 10 years, a 22-track, two-disc epic, much of which was recorded at his home in Wicklow and features contributions from, according to Paddy, anyone who walked through the door of the house when he was making the album. And finally, Willie Mason, highly regarded American folk rock singer-songwriter, whose 2004 album, Where the Humans Eat, established his name. Album number 5 arrives today. It's called Already Dead. Alan Carr and Nadine O'Regan have been listening. Let's start with Will Young,
Crying on the Bathroom Floor is the new album. This is the title track.
Give me that diamond ring. Give me that love on the movie screen. And I won't feel a thing. Promise I won't feel a thing. Give me that kiss goodnight. Give me a call, tell me it's alright. And I won't feel a thing.
Crying on the Bathroom Floor, title track from Will Young's new album. And Nadine O'Regan and Alan Carr with me to speak about the three albums this evening. And as we were listening, Nadine, you were brought down memory lane back to watching Pop Idol and adoring Will Young.
Oh God, I absolutely loved Will Young. I thought he was a cut above. I still think he's a cut above, actually. The kind of artist that tends to pop up on some of those reality TV shows. Not that the singers aren't good, but often they're not what you might call creative artists. They're not likely to record their own songs. They're more likely to do interpretations of other people's songs. But straight from the get-go, I thought Will Young had a natural style to him. His vocals were very honeyed. He made, God, I'm going to sound like Simon Cowell. He made songs his own. Sorry.
It's a no from me.
But I mean it in a sense that some of those artists that came out of those shows, if you heard them on a song, they were very indistinguishable from each other. Whereas there was a timbre to his vocal and a very particular style that meant that when he came on the radio, you would know it was a Will Young song.
Yeah. So, and this is an album that gives him a chance to do precisely that, because this is essentially a cover album. And given that, or a covers album rather, given that he has that background in the TV reality show, if you like, it's a brave enough thing to do. But he's far enough away from that at this stage.
Well,
really,
I think,
Alan,
that anytime you talk to Will Young, and I've interviewed him a few times over the past 20 years since he was on One Pop Idol, he's always very happy to talk about it. But it's just such a gap between what he did back then in 2002. And you, as you said, he's won an Ivor Novello. He's now quite an acclaimed actor. He's an author and all those other things. So in tackling this album, I think that he wanted to kind of show that he could kind of approach these songs, which are made famous. These are 10 female artists after all, and he doesn't change the gender. And I applaud him for not going down the route of, you know, Rod Stewart or, God forbid, Michael Bublé and doing the Great American Songbook. So he's taken these terribly modern and kind of relatively new songs by fairly well-known female artists who are also left-wing, and treated them in his own kind of inimitable style. My only criticism, I suppose, is that everything sounds the same.
Yeah,
and I found that a bit disappointing.
Yeah, I was going to ask Nadine precisely that, because he has taken these, you know, songs, and Muna being the artist in question in Crying on the Bathroom Floor. But if you look down the list of people that he's taking on here, Bat for Lashes, Robin London Grammar, Everything But the Girl is in there as well. You know, lots of difficult songs that were great hits for those involved.
Yeah, I mean,
is it too much Will Young and not enough of the original song?
Well, I think his taste is impeccable. I mean, he's picked some wonderful songs like Missing, Losing You. Daniel is such a great track from Bat for Lashes. So one thing that he's done is he's taken tracks that are genuinely the kind of tracks that you would like a new generation or his own fans to discover because they're so good. But where we hit problems is that he does Will Youngify them too much. I mean, if you think of a track like Strong from London Grammar, that original track is almost operatic in scale. The drama of it, the breadth of the emotion conveyed on that song is enormous. I mean, you're thinking of the scale of the likes of a band like Muse, where it's just huge and full blown and full bodied, and Will Young sort of reduces it, you know. I mean, he makes it all a little bit more radio friendly, and while at times and often it's really pleasant, you also find yourself thinking, well, you know what, if you just push the boat out here or maybe thought about a new direction, like some of the best covers of our time, if you take a track like Hallelujah from Jeff Buckley via Leonard Cohen, or Hurt from Johnny Cash via Nine Inch Nails, those tracks were radical reinterpretations of another song, and they now are probably more known than the original.
And the song survives, but the artist also puts his or her stamp on it in the process.
That doesn't happen all the time here. Yeah. Now, that said, there are tracks that I absolutely love. I love the title track. I think his version of Daniel is pretty good.
Let's have a listen. Let's have a listen to a bit of Daniel.
Daniel, when I
Right, just wanted to listen to a little bit of Daniel. I was saying, as I was listening to the album, when Daniel finished and we went into Crying on the Bathroom Floor, I thought, oh, have I got it on repeat? Because they really did sound very similar to me.
There is a problem there. I think Daniel, originally going back for last year, he really does rob it of its you know, Bronte heroine drama and reduces it down to something quite bland. The version of London Grammar song, Strong, you know, it's good to show off his falsetto. And I think the songs kind of suit the kind of the studied melancholia of Will Young's voice, and he really kind of hits kind of heights of rapture and depths of sorrow. But it's not Pin-Ups by David Bowie, and it's not kind of The Man Comes Around, the cover version by cover version album by Johnny Cash. That's for sure.
So what are you saying overall then, Alan and Stars?
It's very polite, polished AOR. I would give it 2 stars. I think it's an exercise more than a good album.
Ooh, 2 stars of a Friday evening. And I even saw your eyebrows rise as that happened on your pop idol face going into a crease, Nadine.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, I loved his choice of songs. I love his vocal. Not everything works, but the ones that work, I'll, you know, keep in my own recollection. So 3.5 stars.
3.5 from Nadine. That is Crying on the Bathroom Floor, new album from Will Young. Let's move on to Paddy Kate. The Will Young album is 10 songs long and 41 and a half minutes. Not the case with Paddy Casey. He really has, he's given us 2 albums here, I would say, without
it's
a doubt. It's not just a double album, it's 2 different albums,
Alan. It certainly is. It's a 22-track album, and he hasn't been with us now, Paddy, for 9 years. So he's stored up a lot of songs in the past 9 years. So I think, you know, the name of the album is Turn the Ship Around. I think he's had this ambition to do a kind of an upbeat, electric-sounding album and then a more acoustic album, and he's done this, I think, very well here. I mean, this to me is a bit of a revelation. You'll hear a side of Paddy that you perhaps haven't heard before. So he does joy and he does sorrow very well on this album. 4 sides and 22 good songs.
All right. Well, let's listen to from the first album, if you like, and from side one of album one. This is a song called When She Dances.
When she dances, she screams. Don't need a new lover. Make her feel whole. She got all that she needs right there.
Well, no doubt about it that When She Dances is the happy side of Turn This Ship Around, the new double album from Paddy Casey. I think both you and Alan seem to have more of a penchant for album number one and that upbeat nature that's in there, Nadine.
Well, I really do like the second album as well. It's got a very Nick Drake kind of vibe. It's very mellow. The songs are very cohesive. They blend into each other really, really well. And if you were listening late at night, you would absolutely be delighted to put on this album and listen the whole way through. But the one thing about the first album is that Paddy is trying new things. He's taking chances, and not all the new things work, actually. There's a track called You Are The One where, honestly, it sounds like he's leading a conga line around his sitting room, and he sounds like he's having brilliant fun. And I respect him for doing that and putting that on the record, but I'm not sure if he brought me on the conga journey.
You'd
with
want to
him.
Be on the conga line with him.
But having said that, when the chance that he takes, when those kind of opportunities work, as they do on the title track, which I think is really beautiful, and there's a very sweet and upbeat song called the Goodbye Song, he is right on point. You know, you're kind of like, I want to hear this on the radio. I want to hear it in a crowd. I want him to play it from the stage and everyone would enjoy it.
Although I did, when I was listening to When She Dances and some of the tracks on album number one, I did get this sense of some of these will, as Paddy has in the past, these could be great accompanying songs to television series, particularly American television series, and why not? If you
and
get
and
the,
a very,
if you get
a very lucrative outlet that is. I think this is an album that's kind of bristling with singles, really, but I don't think it's going to get the attention it deserves, because there's always been a degree of snobbery about Paddy Casey that he's not seen as cool. And I don't care about that kind of thing, because I think he can write melodies very well and he's a good lyricist. And I think he's got a really good ear for a pop song here on this album. In particularly. The album that you like is not quite Blood on the Tracks. It is the album that explores a breakup that he went through quite a long time ago, about 6 years ago. And he's got that kind of romantic sadness down better than most singers in this country, I think.
I like the romantic sadness, you see. Let's have a listen. Let's have a listen.
Don't we all, Sean?
There you are.
The night time never tasted quite so sweet. And there you are. One day you're gonna be a star. And you're gonna...
I don't think there's too much heartbreak in there. There's a touch of positivity for sure. And there you are from Paddy Casey. I was asking as we were listening to that, Nadine, about where the various artists appear. You were both saying that Declan O'Rourke is in the When She Dances song that we just heard. Are they kind of just come in and give a little bit to the song? They don't take over the song.
Yeah, so he's talked about how often if people would drop by the house, he would sort of say, do you want to pop on a microphone there and see how we get on? And what he said in interviews is that he's looking for people who are not, or he's not even looking for people, it's just if they happen to be there and they have a voice. And what he would prefer, he has said, is not that they are perfect singers, but that they can communicate an emotion or a feeling in the song. And actually, that's such an interesting line from him, because I think it's always about, it's music for music's sake. He's not in it for the fame or the, you know, the accolades that might come from the critics or whoever. Like, he's really just releasing music in his own time, in his own way, and very bloody minded about it, which I respect.
Yeah, and also that one of the songs that you're talking about, People Who Have Something to Say, I think Falling to Pieces is a song that features his daughter Saoirse, and they work really well together, and it's a nice song in my book.
And Kim Hayden is in there as well.
Okay, stars from you, Alan. Did you enjoy this?
I really did enjoy it. As I said, it's a bit of a revelation. He's not Fionn Regan and he's certainly not Declan O'Rourke, but he's doing his own thing, and I really enjoyed this. So he's really pushed himself. He sounds like he's having a great time. I'd give it a 3.5 out of 5.
3.5. So he has kind of turned the ship around for you. Has he turned the ship around for you, and how many stars, Nadine?
Also 3.5. I think there are a lot of great melodies on this record and a very solid production, and it's the work of somebody who's just in it for the tunes, for the music.
All right, and that's not a bad reason to be there, is it? There we go. That's Paddy Casey and Turn This Ship Around. Let's finish up this evening. Our third album is Already Dead from Willie Mason, and here from that album is a song called Oh My Country.
Oh my country, 'tis of thee my children dream of in their sleep. The boogeyman, the buttered bread, the hooligan, the color red, the blood that spills on muddy streets, the ground that swells the chicken's feet. It's more than one can ever say. Oh my country, flags will fray.
Oh my country, from Willie Mason and his son, and his new album Already Dead. He's not a happy boy singing about his country there, Alan, is he? They refer to him, NME at any rate, folk rock's mystery man.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's been around since 2004. He started off as a teenage prodigy with his first album, Where the Humans Eat. He's only 19 when he made that. And this, he's done a bit of a Paddy Casey here. He's been absent for 9 years, and he's come back with a hell of a lot to say. This is a heavy, heavy album, Sean. Not so much musically, but certainly spiritually and lyrically. He's now 36 and he's got a lot to say about post-Trump America. That song you just played there, Oh My Country, that could be a Randy Newman song as far as I'm concerned. It's got the same mordant Newman style to it, and he really comes across like a wounded poet. But there's a lot of anger here as well. The single from the album is called Youth on a Spit, and it's just kind of apocalyptic dread seizes some of the album. Some of the other songs are full of sorrow and regret. He's really concerned about the way America has gone in the past 9 years.
But sometimes if you listen to an album that's full of concern and regret, by the time you get to track 6 or 7, you're going, oh, come on, give me a little bit of, you know, light at the end of the tunnel. I didn't find myself looking for light at the end of the tunnel here.
Not at all. And I actually think, you know, that track that we played is, you know, potentially a little misleading, because there are other songs that, despite the fact that the lyrics can be very dark, the melodies can be quite uplifting. And it reminds me a little bit of, well, the album as a whole reminds me of, say, the work of like Badly Drawn Boy and the Hour of the Bewilderbeast, or Simple Kid, or early Beck, you know, that kind of shuffling, ramshackle, but definitely way with a tune where you find yourself, you know, clicking your fingers even as you're thinking about the world's woes. And actually he was talking about the lyrics and the title, the album title, which, you know, Already Dead. And he said about how he'd experienced quite a few negative times, and he said the line came into my head, you can't kill me, I'm already dead, which is about embracing the darkness but daring to carry forward with light, which I think is a very good summation of the record.
And that is in the lyric is in the opening track, which was one that you picked out there, Alan, Youth on a Spit. Let's have a listen.
Final analysis, just a case of paralysis. It's a cultural rock, a new state of shock. Book of the reference, a map of repentance. The hope is to learn, a cultural turn. You can't kill me, I'm already dead. Already dead, already dead.
Never heard You Can't Kill Me, I'm Already Dead. Sounds such a happy, like a happy little lyric in the midst of all of that. Just briefly, the story of how this, I was saying it takes a lot of effort to be ramshackle.
Yeah.
The story around this album, briefly, Nadine?
Well, he's described how there was a girl that he decided he wanted to make a mixtape for, but to do that he had to set up a bunch of equipment because he wanted to dub some vinyl. So he dusted off all his old equipment and started plugging everything in, and then he just says he got carried away and started making music of his own to put on the mixtape with interludes, and then it became full-blown songs. And in the end he was like, oh, I might as well make an album. Like, that's where it came from.
I wonder, did he give her the album, and what does she think? But it's not her opinion we're looking for this evening, Alan. It's yours.
Yeah, I really, really like this. It's very diverse. It's not as kind of down and angry as you might think. There's some funny songs and some kind of nice, gentle songs here. It's full of sonic surprises, Sean, and the observations are well worth hearing. Has the makings of a modern classic. This is a 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5. What are you saying, Nadine?
4 out of 5 also. Really enjoyed it. Very original. And yeah, I'll be playing this again and again.
All right. That's a 2 4s there for Willie Mason and Already Dead. The other two albums we're speaking about, Paddy Casey's Turn This Ship Around and Will Young's Crying on the Bathroom Floor, bringing us to the end of Friday's Arena. Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Dunn was on sound tonight. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you Monday evening once again, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. In the